The matter of Samuel Mejia versus Quest Diagnostics et al. May we please have appearances of counsel? Welcome, counsel. Mr. Brennan, please go ahead.
May it please the court, I have waived my preliminary statement, but I would respectfully request a short two-minute rebuttal, Your Honor.
That's fine.
Thank you. I will rely on my papers and obviously invite questions, but I was wondering if I could just succinctly, in one sentence, present our position. And our position is very clearly that if a plaintiff fails to file suit or perfect that suit with an affidavit of merit against a licensed professional, that plaintiff is not allowed to recover from that licensed professional, either directly or indirectly through a contribution claim.
That's your first statement. So let me ask you this question.
Succinct.
Yeah.
Succinct.
You can come back.
Why should our comparative negligence law and our contribution law be any different in a professional malpractice case from any other tort case?
Sure.
So when the plaintiff decides which defendant it decides to sue, and wants to lay fault or as much fault as possible on that defendant, why is it not then the obligation of that defendant to bring in whatever other parties it believes should share fault through an allocation?
Yes, Your Honor. And I think that goes right to the heart of the matter that brings us here today. And my answer to you would be that there has to be a harmony of the three statutes. And I believe respectfully the appellate division only tried to balance the equity of two of the three statutes. The appellate division tried to balance the equities of the joint tortfeasor law and also the comparative negligence law, but left out the whole affidavit of merit law. And that goes to Your Honor's question. Why does it matter? Because that's what this separates a case from a normal slip and fall case. Or a car accident case.
Wasn't there a motion filed for a declaration that there was no need to file an affidavit of merit against your client?
There was.
And had that been filed, you would agree that you would be, even though it wasn't filed by the plaintiff, because it's a contribution claim,
yes,
your client would be responsible. And there was no opposition to that motion. So aren't we in a different ball game here? Because now there's no opposition to that motion, so there's no requirement. If you follow what you seek, doesn't that just swallow the entire affidavit of merit as to co-defendants?
I don't think it would, Your Honor, but Your Honor correctly states the record that it was a little bit more nuanced than that, Your Honor, if I may. There was a Ferrara conference / case management conference,
right,
and both my firm and plaintiff's firm very clearly stated to the judge that it was our position that the third-party plaintiff had to file an affidavit of merit. That was our position.
But there was a motion.
It
was not opposed.
You're absolutely
and
correct.
I'm not suggesting other recourse, but that's where we are.
Well, we're there to a certain extent, Your Honor, but my focus, respectfully, is not on the obligations between the third-party plaintiff and the third-party defendant. My focus for my entire argument and the argument below is the focus on the plaintiff vis-a-vis the licensed professional that he didn't sue.
But there's a nuance there, because the plaintiff is not recovering from your client directly.
Correct.
Plaintiff's recovering a full amount from the direct defendant.
Correct.
And the only amount that's going is to that defendant from your client by way of contribution. I may be,
yes,
paid directly to the plaintiff by check. That's the way insurance carriers work. But the claim's still not the direct claim of the plaintiff against your client. It's a contribution claim by the third-party plaintiff.
100% correct.
So the argument you make as a direct is not really, to some degree, not accurate.
You're 100% correct. That's why I tried to focus on direct or indirect through a contribution claim, Your Honor, it's still coming out of my pocket. It's still coming out of my client's pocket. And I think one of the bedrock principles of litigation is that a plaintiff should only be able to recover against the party that they sue.
What would that do to the contribution statute?
Well, because the contribution, I'm sorry, Your
no,
Honor.
No, go ahead. What would that do to joint tort fees or contribution statute? It would disappear in legal malpractice cases or professional malpractice cases.
Well, it would only disappear under certain circumstances. Because, Your Honor, as I stand here today, there's not been a trier of fact who has said that plaintiff made the wrong decision. Plaintiff may have made the entirely right decision. We won't know. But if a trier of fact ultimately finds that my client was liable, why shouldn't the plaintiff be stuck with that decision?
Because they decided, because just from the beginning of your statement,
yes,
they decided to pick the person, the defendant, that they felt was the most responsible. They're not under our law for the last, I don't know how many decades,
sure,
the plaintiff gets the right to decide who to sue.
Absolutely.
There may be other parties that could sue, but they can't be forced to sue other parties.
Absolutely.
And if the defendant feels that there are other people who should share fault, they bring them in. That's the way it's always worked, unless we decide some different operation of law now.
Well, first of all, I agree with every sentiment Your Honor voiced, except I'm not forcing them to do anything. And if Your Honor's all rule in for what I want, we're not forcing the plaintiffs to do anything.
They have sued you.
Yes.
And they're saying, if we hit you for 60%,
correct,
under the law, we get 100%. And then you go chase down the other people who may be 40% liable.
Yes.
That's your obligation.
Yes.
That's what they're saying.
And
you're
right.
And that's the way it ordinarily works.
Yes. And respectfully, that was the way things ordinarily worked until the legislature saw differently. The legislature, and we really can't I certainly won't second guess the wisdom of the legislature. The legislature placed such importance on cases that differ from slip and fall cases or car accident cases. When you want to sue a licensed professional, you need an affidavit of merit.
Look, the legislature did not say, plaintiff, you have to sue every licensed professional who may have some degree of fault.
Sure.
They haven't said that. The only thing that they had said is that the person you sue, you have to file an affidavit of merit. That's all they've said.
Yes. Your Honor, if you reject my initial premise that it makes no difference whether they're trying to collect from me directly or indirectly, then I have no argument. I have no argument.
So but they get – I'm sorry, Chief.
Go ahead.
You're saying the plaintiff ends up recovering against you in an indirect way, even though they chose
absolutely
not to sue you. But the problem with that is that if they can go after the other defendant for if we're talking about the 60% plus
correct
scenario, they can go over the after the other defendant for all of the damages. They're not getting a dollar more because that defendant's turning around and cross-claiming against you or third-party claiming against you. They're allowed to collect the entire amount, correct?
They are.
Okay. So when you are saying that plaintiff has chosen not to sue your client
correct
but still will collect from their client, that's not true, is it?
Well, they're taking advantage of the joint tort fees or contribution
not
law,
for their own benefit. No, they're not doing anything with the
yes
joint tort feesers. The plaintiff is suing Dr. A, chooses not to sue Dr. B. If the Dr. A is only going to be liable in terms of potential ultimate liability if his fault is over 60%, correct?
Correct.
If it's 30%, he's only going to, and there's $1 million or $100,000 verdict or whatever it may be, or multi-million, then that doctor's liability is going to be limited to that 30%.
Yes. Yes.
Okay, so that's not an issue. There's not a dollar more that's coming out in that scenario. Let's say it's 75% liability, okay? So they are potentially liable for the entire thing, for the entire judgment in that case. They turn around and seek contribution against your client to pay back some of what they're paying the plaintiff.
Mm-hmm.
But it has no benefit to the plaintiff.
Well,
you see what I'm saying?
The plaintiff
gets the same dollar amount anyway, no matter what happens.
See, I look at it a different way, Your Honor, and I submit to you that they're basically, under the scenario that Your Honor just outlined, they're benefiting from their wrong tactical trial decision.
If
they are.
The doctor is not judgment-proof, and I suspect the doctor is not judgment-proof, how is that true?
Well, it's true because if we take Your Honor's scenario, let's take a, to make it easy, a 60-point scenario, where they find that Quest was 60% responsible.
Right.
They're going to collect 100%, they can, from Quest.
Right.
Quest is then going to turn to my client, who, as I stand here today, no one has filed an affidavit of merit against a licensed physician.
And they're going to seek the 40%.
And they're
going to
seek the 40%.
So
should Quest have filed an affidavit of merit?
What?
Should Quest have filed an affidavit of merit?
100% yes.
Okay, so the reason we're here today is unique to this case because there was a motion filed by Quest seeking a declaration that they did not have to pursue an affidavit of merit against your client. It was unopposed. It was granted. If they had filed an affidavit of merit, you'd have no argument today. And the reason we're here today is because of that declaration,
sure,
which was unopposed.
See,
so
it's
not unique.
Yes, Your Honor. I respectfully disagree. Because we're making that decision with the benefit of hindsight. What I'm saying and my position is that when we start the case, a plaintiff's attorney, if this is before a third-party case, a plaintiff's attorney has to file an affidavit of merit against the defendant if they eventually want to recover indirectly through a contribution, regardless of whether a third-party plaintiff eventually files an affidavit of merit. That's my position.
When Quest brings you in,
yes, Your Honor,
through a third-party complaint,
yes,
what's the underlying theory as to why you should be on the hook?
Well, that's a great point, and there is no underlying theory because, Your Honor, and this is kind of getting in the weeds a little bit, but I'll go there because Your Honor is directing me there, and it's an excellent point. I owe no duty of care to Quest. I'm a treating OBGYN. I don't owe a duty of care to Quest. So what is their theory of liability? It's a pure contribution theory.
What's wrong with that?
The statute provides
for that. And the standard language is very general. If I'm liable for more than my share, essentially it says,
sure,
you pay, right?
Your Honor, I wasn't saying there's anything wrong with it. I was just answering the Chief Justice's question.
So keep going because I want to hear the extent to which the root of the theory lies in fault and negligence.
Yes. And it's interesting because when we look at the procedural ramifications on a third-party complaint, a party really should, in pleadings, outline the factual basis for that contribution and indemnification claim. They can't say that I'm liable to the third-party plaintiff. You see, we're in a little bit uncharted territory because what we're really trying to decide here, we know what Burt says. We know when there's a direct claim against a physician, we know what the rules are.
We do? That assumes that Burt's right.
Well, exactly. Well, point well taken, Your Honor. I did misspeak. But Your Honor, this body basically put its stamp of approval on Burt in Jones versus Maury Pierce.
Jones is completely different from
Burt. Different factually. I agree.
Because in Jones, the plaintiff prejudiced the defendant,
mm-hmm,
by taking the case to Pennsylvania and preventing the defendant from,
correct,
filing a tort claims notice.
Correct.
And that's totally different from Burt.
I understand. But towards Your Honor's point, so we're really in uncharted territory, respectfully, I think.
Can I ask you to finish the thought? You've said there's a duty owed to Quest,
correct,
by your client.
Correct.
What have they said?
Well, they haven't said anything other than they're putting me on notice that they want to be able to collect pursuant to the joint tortfeasor law. That's what they said. Because, and in fairness to them, in fairness to Quest, I don't know what else they could say, quite frankly. I guess theoretically what they could say is, hey, look, if I'm liable, you're also liable to the plaintiff because you didn't do A, B, C, or D. But they didn't do that by way of affidavit of merit. And eventually when they filed their expert report 2 years after the third-party complaint was filed, they outlined an allegation. Judge, the allegation against me, Your Honor, is that somehow the OBGYN, based upon the symptomology that the female plaintiff, decedent, was saying to us, we should have somehow realized that the pap smears were wrong, and we should have ordered some type of diagnostic testing. That's the theory against my client.
That's facts and the ultimate liability. That's not an argument as to as to the issue today. And you keep saying there was no affidavit or merit filed. And I asked you earlier, should they have filed it? And you said yes. And there's a reason why one wasn't filed. It was the court entered an order that none was required. And who does that lie with?
Well, Judge,
was that motion opposed?
No, it wasn't. And
was there a motion for reconsideration filed?
It was not.
Was there an interlocutory appeal application?
It was not. And Your Honor, I guess this sounds like by the way, not to cast aspersions on my esteemed colleague, but the plaintiff never opposed that order as well.
Why would they?
Let me ask you something. Right,
it was against your doctor. Your client?
I'll tell you why. Because, Your Honor, every single percentage of liability against Fernandez is a potential percentage out of their pocket.
If it applies the way it always applies. The plaintiff sues the defendant. If he gets 60%, he collects 100%, unless this court's going to say otherwise now.
Judge, that's a big if.
Let me ask you very fundamentally.
Madam Justice, excuse me. That's a big if, Judge. You can't assume that they're going to get 60% against Quest.
And if they only get 59?
Yes.
Then they made a wrong decision by not bringing in you.
And they should have opposed that motion, shouldn't they have?
Yeah,
they should have said that the third-party plaintiff should.
But they had an expert's report that said your guy wasn't liable. I presume you're going to examine, cross-examine, and go up one side and down the other from that plaintiff's expert to try to get yourself off the hook from any exposure in this at all.
Well, Your Honor,
isn't that how it's supposed to work?
Your Honor, plaintiffs don't have an expert report in this case.
No, but the defendant who brought you in does.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Let me ask you very fundamentally.
I do have that report.
But they do have an expert's report, the plaintiff, that does not implicate your client.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
And you can go up that expert and down the other side and explain how your client doesn't have any responsibility.
100%. But
let the jury figure it out. If it turns out that they're wrong, they took the risk.
They said
we may end up only recovering a piece of what the jury gives us.
I'm so sorry. Yes.
You can't ask them in bad faith to join you and offer an affidavit of merit report, an affidavit of merit that they don't have.
My position is my client should not have to go through the expense and the inconvenience of a trial where there was no affidavit of merit filed against them.
So my guess is you probably and your colleagues are lobbying the legislature as we speak to deal with this situation that we presume the legislature understood when they said if you're on the hook for 60%, you're on the hook for all of it, and you gave every defendant the incentive to bring in anybody else they could find to be exposed.
I don't know if they looked at it in that nuanced way.
I was a former legislator. We looked at everything.
This body has decided more medical malpractice litigation dealing with the affidavit of merit, I think, than any other case.
But let me ask you just
Ferrara and everything else. So
let me ask you just very fundamentally,
yes,
and obviously you're well experienced in all this. The idea of both contribution and the third party claim don't answer me and said I'm correct until I finish the sentence. You may not agree with me. The idea is that the plaintiff sues the maybe 50 defendants, and the defendants are new to the case potentially. They may not know who of all of the remaining 49 defendants they may actually have a claim against. But they assert the claim at that stage in a very general way, and that's what the statutes envision. You would agree with that?
The affidavit of merit statute?
I'm not talking about affidavit of merit. I'm talking about the CNA and the joint tortfeasor's contribution law.
Okay.
They simply, for example, I'm sure you do it all the time, you file a cross-claim that simply generally asserts common law indemnification and the statutory contribution.
Correct.
Right? Okay.
That's correct.
And at that stage, you're not required to say, let's use a cross-claim as an example. You're not required to say that I'm defendant A and defendant B, I know all about his liability or her liability, I know all about why, here are my theories, and set out a complete complaint.
True.
You would agree
on
with that?
A cross-claim, true.
Now, on a third-party complaint, they're pretty darn general at the beginning of a case, are they not?
I'm not sure they should be, but yes, they are.
But the statutes envision that at that stage, the claim can be asserted in a general way, which is to say, if we're talking about contribution, if I get too much on the hook, you're helping me out, Mr. Third Party Defendant. You would agree with that? In a general way, you're allowed to plead that.
In a general way, you are.
Seems to me your theory is saying, change that. Make a claimant who's asserting nothing more than contribution and indemnification do everything that a plaintiff has to do to file a claim.
Okay.
That's what you're saying.
And can I defend that?
Well, absolutely. But that is what you're saying,
well,
is it not?
Well, it's not exactly what I'm saying, because okay. When I woke up this morning and had my coffee, I wanted to come here and talk about why a plaintiff has to file an affidavit of merit. Now we're talking about why a third-party plaintiff should have to file an affidavit of merit, and I'd be happy to
respond that's what
to
I'm
that
asking.
Argument. Your Honor, here's the problem. Me as Dr. Fernandez, nobody has come by way of an affidavit of merit and swore or affirmed that my client did anything wrong. So if you as a third-party plaintiff are going to inject that doctor to that type of exposure, it's a new claim.
You should be obligated to file an affidavit of merit. But you haven't brought that issue before us. That would be very nice. What you want is an affidavit of merit. So the issue would be is whether or not a third-party plaintiff under the Affidavit of Merit statute is required to file an Affidavit of Merit against the third-party defendant. That's a great issue.
Yes.
Who knows how it would come out? You haven't brought that to us, have you?
Your Honor, I'm only respectfully answering the questions that Alana
asked. I understand that, but you're asking for an extra level of protection.
Well,
it may be there.
Yes.
But quite frankly, you're not going to know unless someone brings that issue to this court.
It has to be a party, not an amicus.
Okay. Well, it's going to get here eventually. One would think it would get here eventually. But again, I clearly understand that if Your Honors reject my position, but I just want to make sure you understand my position before you reject it.
But let's play that out, because nobody's even remotely suggesting that your client can be floating along all the way to trial not knowing what the theories are against him, right? The fact is the third-party defendant has an obligation to produce an expert report.
2 years after they bring me into
the
case.
But prior to trial with
Correct.
Sufficient time to prepare for trial, just like, so you get the benefit of, whenever the court decides an expert report is due, you get the benefit of the requirement that they have the right expert and the expert goes through the proper methodology under 702,
yes.
703, and sets forth the whole thing well in advance of trial, and then you have the opportunity to respond with your own expert.
I respectfully disagree for two reasons. The whole theory behind the Affidavit of Merit statute is that a physician or a licensed professional would know very early in the litigation that there's merit on the case. So 2 years later is not early in the litigation, number one. Number two, Your Honor, this court in many cases has pointed out to litigants that when you raise your right hand and you swear or you affirm, that means something. And there's a case on point, I believe it's Latia, and I apologize if I'm killing the case, one of my colleagues may be able to point it out, where the court held that you need an affidavit of merit. It doesn't matter how good your expert report is.
Well,
you need somebody swearing.
As a plaintiff, but a plaintiff knows their case. They have time, they have 2 years to develop the case.
Right.
They have time to consult with experts. You're saying that somebody who just got sued last week has to provide you with the same information that the plaintiff would.
An affidavit of merit,
that's again,
when I'm being led down this road, being asked that question, yes. But again, I am saying, and again, I don't want to repeat myself, but I want to make sure it's clear, irrespective of what the obligation is between the third-party plaintiff and the third-party defendant, my clear position, which may very easily be rejected.
We understand it, and you're not waiving it. You can state it again, but don't worry.
No, if we get it, we get it. I mean, so I've spent more time, respectfully, arguing a point that I'm not even raising, which is fine. But
well, we have a habit of doing that, or at least
I'm
I
sorry.
Do.
Oh, no. Far be it from me to question you know, Your Honor's on that issue. But, you know, I, irrespective of that, I think plaintiffs are benefiting in this case. They're benefiting. They're doing an end run around the affidavit of merit statute because ultimately they're benefiting by the joint tortfeasor law. Who's looking out for me in this case? Who's looking out for Dr. Fernandez? Everybody's looking out.
You're looking out for Dr. Fernandez, and if that expert report that comes in during discovery doesn't do what it needs to do, you're in there with a motion to get the case thrown
out. True, but respectfully, I think we're tossing aside the affidavit of merit statute. And the appellate division and what I'm hearing today is we're so focused on the Comparative Negligence Act and the Joint Tortfeasors Act that we're just tossing aside the affidavit of merit statute. That's what protects me in this case.
We're not this appeal.
The affidavit of merit, where the rubber hits the road,
yes.
The affidavit of merit statute is in this case, and the issue is not before us, is whether or not the third-party plaintiff had to file an affidavit of merit before bringing you in. But that's not the issue.
That is not the issue I'm raising. Or
and that would give you, if this court were to say yes, then you'd be very happy. That's all the protection you want.
Well.
Anything else you'd like to add?
No, Your Honor, thank you. And as I said, I'll rely on my papers, and I have reserved, respectfully, 2 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you so much
thank
for your
you.
Time and attention.
Mr. Poe.
Thank you, Your Honors. May we please the Court, Eric Poe, on behalf of Amicus, New Jersey Pure. As you know from our brief, we are a direct writer of medical malpractice insurance in the state of New Jersey, and we employ our own internal law firm to defend our doctors, and I'm not only the attorney, but also the chief litigation officer overseeing these claims. And I want to be very brief because I think my esteemed colleague did a very good job of addressing many of the issues that you guys brought up. But I do have two idiomatic themes. And before we reach those themes today before the court, I'd like to share a very important fact that I think gives those themes some credence, and that is that the average time span between the time in which a lawsuit is filed against a doctor in the state of New Jersey and when that doctor gets to defend themselves and exonerate themselves from those acts of alleged negligence is 5 years. That's 5 years of depositions, subpoenas, and other discovery requests, closing their practices, not seeing their patients to simply get their day in court. That is a significant burden, and I think it's a very important fact that the legislature recognized and appreciated when it came up with the affidavit of merit statute.
Is it through an affidavit of non-involvement the doctor can file immediately and get out of the case?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so 5 years, but if you're not involved and you file that affidavit, you're out.
Well, Your Honor, respectfully, if they do have an affidavit of merit, that becomes a contested issue. You don't get out if you simply say you have not involvement and then you have a plaintiff attorney.
That's not the facts you presented. You said a doctor is blameless, spends 5 years depositions. He would only spend 5 years if it was an affidavit of merit stating that there was reasonable to believe that he deviated from the standard of care. But if
there's
an affidavit of non-involvement, those 5 years are non-existent.
Why did the legislature say the plaintiff? You know, when you look through their statutes under Title IIA, they understand clearly. Well, I won't let our former legislator speak to that, but they understand what a third-party plaintiff is.
Correct.
You agree with that?
Yes.
And they understand what a cross-claimant is. They understand what a contribution claim is. They said the plaintiff. And they also talked about, tied it in with the complaint. Now, they could have said the plaintiff or, in the case of a third-party complaint, the third-party plaintiff, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, they could do what they want to do with that, but they haven't done it.
Well, Your Honor, I think our position on this is that a third-party plaintiff is still a plaintiff. And so there is still a requirement for you to state a cause of action. So earlier, Your Honor, it said that, well, a third-party complaint can simply just say contribution indemnification in order to continue. Our position is that the rules of civil procedure require that third-party plaintiff actually has to state a cause of action.
Well,
when the doctors that you and your company insures, and there are multiple doctors, and they choose to file claims against one another, whether they're third-party complaints or they're cross-claims, they use that general language, do they not?
In what context, Your Honor?
Well, just contribution means that in the event that I'm held liable for more than my share, and I'm making it more colloquial than it is, that you are liable for part of that, Mr. Co-Defendant.
Yes, if they can perfect a claim against us.
Right. So you would not want your insureds in that situation to have those claims barred simply because they don't say count one and go through the standard of care and set forth information about the facts that they don't even have yet.
Your Honor, I would rather take that burden than have this court render a different decision than it did in the appellate division in Burt or synonymously in Jones if you take the Tort Claims Act. And our position on this is that this court 2 years ago had to weigh and balance all these statutes, and instead of the Tort Claims Act, we simply believe the Affidavit of Merit statute has the equal respect and credence that this court should give regarding whether or not you can pursue a claim against the doctor.
You may be right, but we're not here to answer that question.
Well, Your Honor, I would respectfully say that I think that this court is answering that question, that the question is whether or not in the formula that this court derived 2 years ago in Jones versus Maury Pierce is the similar weighing and formula of the balance of whether or not those statutes can be harmonized.
I'm not saying we can't do whatever we decide to do, but there was an opportunity to raise the failure to provide an affidavit of merit by the third-party plaintiff. There was that issue, and that issue essentially was waived because the motion was not opposed.
Our position is that we question whether or not you can waive a statutory requirement, right? So the reason why counsel, in our opinion, did not oppose that motion is, A, because there's a Ferreira conference in which they actually agreed and demanded an affidavit of merit and wasn't done. Secondly, if at the law of the land at the time on the Burt case actually stands for the notion that an affidavit of merit was not required in a cross-claim, even though in Burt's case they called it a cross-claim at the time that the appellate division heard that case.
Allocation. Burt's about allocation of fault. Burt is not quite this situation.
Well, Your Honor, we would respectfully suggest that the Burt is exactly this fact pattern. The only difference is that in this case, the plaintiff actually went to a physician that they chose, and they said, we can't get an affidavit of merit. How we believe that's not analogous to Burt when they sue a doctor, and then they can't comply with a statutory requirement of getting an affidavit.
Would it have made a difference if they didn't get... If the plaintiff just decided it did not want to sue Dr. Fernandez, wasn't that within their right? Or no?
It is within their right, Your Honor.
So why should that be held against them? They feel that Quest is a responsible party, and they're pursuing them. And if Quest feels that there are people who should share, then they bring them in. That's just the way it's always worked.
Right, Your Honor. We don't disagree with that. Here's the only thing that we disagree with. The fact that when Your Honor suggested that it only has a penalty against the plaintiff if they get 60% or more, right? And if they get 59% of an allocation by a trier of fact, they're willing to accept the fact that they don't get to collect whatever percentage is put on
Fernandez. They may have made a huge mistake by not bringing in someone else.
Right, but what I don't know if everyone appreciates is the fact that we're allowing this big if to occur requires an insurance company to actually invest well over $150,000 in 5 years defending that doctor with the notion that the big if would not occur. So we're going to raise the rates for all of our doctors, and we're going to have to defend doctors through 5 years of this simply to hope that they're going to get 59% or less, and it would have absolutely no effect on us.
How about filing a motion to dismiss for failure to provide an affidavit of merit?
Well, Your Honor, I agree with that. I would say
this global catastrophe you're painting doesn't exist, because if something comes in like that, you have very competent counsel who will file a motion to dismiss for an affidavit of merit. The court may or may not grant it, depending on what's there. I'm not suggesting. But that takes care of this catastrophe of spending $150,000 for 5 years, because you could be out immediately if there's no affidavit of merit, like perhaps this case.
You're right, Ron. I can't address the specific procedural question as to why we didn't oppose something that, in the Burt case, suggested we don't need to.
And this case is different from Jones, because in Jones, the plaintiff prejudiced the defendant's ability to file a Tort Claims Act. And in this case, the plaintiff didn't do anything to prejudice Quest from filing an affidavit of merit. And that's a huge difference.
But Your Honor, I would offer to the court that in that Jones case, are we suggesting that if the plaintiff didn't do that the decision by this court would be different? I believe that the Comparative Negligence Act, this court would have weighed that and said, look, the plaintiff had every opportunity to perfect a claim against the school. They didn't do it, regardless if it's a third-party complaint or not.
They don't want to bring them in? I'm trying to understand why in professional negligence cases, our comparative comparative negligence and contribution law works differently. Merely because there's an affidavit of merit required. That's what I'm not understanding.
For two reasons. Number one, I think it's very important to recognize that plaintiff attorneys take these cases and they have a two-year statute of limitations to examine this. It's not like the plaintiff has the ability with the same medical records that the defendant that files a third-party claim has at that time.
But they're not required to bring in parties they don't want to litigate against. Then it's up to the defendant to bring them in. That's just the way our contribution law has worked for the last 100 years.
Yeah, we agree, Your Honor. The only part that we would say that we disagree with is the fact that if they choose not to bring somebody in, they can't also say that it's an undue burdensome situation if they suffer the consequences that that person is somebody that's uncollectible.
They're willing to accept the consequences. The legislature said, here's how you allocate, here's the way it gets paid, and if they don't get 60% on somebody, they're hurt. They are taking the consequences. They are taking the risk.
But as my colleague, Mr. Brennan, said very well, in my opinion, who's looking out for the doctor that has to go through the 5 years of this case?
Well, wait a minute.
Or the insurance company that has to defend
them. That's a different question now. All these doctors that are worried about each other's premiums, worried about each other's liability, are suing each other, and the plaintiff is supposed to be worried about that? The legislature's not worried about that, but we're supposed to worry about that?
I think the part that we have to worry about is the fact that the plaintiff had the exact same facts and medical records. We allow John Doe's
and had an expert that said Dr. Fernandez is not responsible. What the heck was the plaintiff supposed to do? Sue him in bad faith?
Well, Your Honor, it's funny because I would say that when I added two idiomatic themes today, one of the themes was getting your cake and eating it too. And our adversaries and amicus here are wanting to argue that in this case, they comply with the affidavit of merit statute simply because they go to a doctor who examines the medical records and say, I don't think I can author an affidavit that your doctor did anything wrong, but they want to get the benefits of the cake.
Their argument is very different from that. Their argument is we're not pursuing a direct claim against this defendant, Fernandez. We're just not. And so they're leaving it to the Comparative Negligence Act to sort out the potential fault, but they're not saying we comply just because we went to a doctor. That's not an argument I saw here.
But Your Honor, aren't they talking out of both sides of their mouth if they're saying that they won't suffer the consequences of where they're saying they're making that decision? They're the architect of their own claim.
Right.
So if
that's a risky.
Contact your office to see who they should sue and who will be approved by you. What doctors that you insure. They can sue whoever they want. If they choose not to sue Dr. Fernandez, that's their choice. Quest brings them in. They now have a claim for contribution. If they're less than 60%, they don't recover the full amount. If they're over 60, they get it from Quest, and Quest will get it from your doctor. But what you suggest is that they should call you first and say, what doctors is it okay for us to sue? They can sue whoever they want.
No, Your Honor, we're simply saying that if you choose not to sue our doctor, and you choose within that two-year statute of limitations reviewing those medical records and not getting an affidavit of merit against us, you don't get rewarded by the fact that through the Joint Contribution Tortfeasor Act, that if that number is over 60%, we're left holding the bag.
This is what I'm missing, frankly, from both of you are fine advocates. I'm not saying this in any critical way. But I don't understand what the argument is. I think the plaintiff's theory is very risky. The plaintiff's theory, and I think you would agree with that, it's very risky. They are, for whatever their reasons, not suing this doctor, they are at a minimum risking an allocation of fault, which would come right off the top of their verdict, correct?
Correct.
And they are potentially also risking with respect to actual liability being assessed, which they can see no part of. In other words, that defendant may be on the hook for some amount, which is only going to go to ameliorate the burden on the other defendant, and it's not going to add to any of the dollars that the plaintiff gets.
But it's only risky if they actually get less than 60% on the direct defendant in which they sued. So the problem is that 60% of uncertainty requires our doctor to sit in litigation for 5 years and for us to spend $150,000.
Only if someone brings you in, then you'll know what your risk is. Okay, so the plaintiff sues the defendant. And as someone pointed out, if the doctors want to start suing doctors, and you represent doctors, then they'll know. They'll know what their obligation is. They'll know what the risk is. You'll know what their risk is early on.
Our position would be that if they can't get an affidavit of merit directly from the plaintiff, then they cannot recover from us.
Understood.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Argyropoulos.
Thank you, Your Honors. A lot of what I intended to say was covered by Your Honor's questions to my colleagues. There is something I would like to highlight, which was not originally part of my argument, but I want to point it out since I heard it, which is that the affidavit of merit is a serious matter. And from a physician's perspective, it's a protection that the legislature has provided to physicians to avoid the very consequences that doctors are facing now as a result of the appellate division below and some of the colloquy that I've heard. We reject that a plaintiff has an absolute right to sue whoever he wants or she wants for medical malpractice. He or she does not. If a plaintiff is unable to obtain an affidavit of merit, just as has happened here, then that plaintiff cannot sue a physician for professional negligence. That's the end of the story.
And that didn't happen here.
In this case, the plaintiff was unable to obtain an affidavit of merit as to Dr. Fernandez.
Correct.
Yet Dr. Fernandez is facing a situation where that doctor's on the hook, despite the fact that there is no claim of professional negligence against the doctor. That's number one. Number two, there's no affidavit of merit where someone has certified as they're required to.
There's a contribution claim. I think you're criticizing the contribution system that we have. There's a contribution claim against the doctor by another defendant. And eventually that contribution claim, one way or another, has to be supported with expert testimony. So it may not be a traditional negligence claim in the sense of I'm a plaintiff and you were negligent, therefore you're liable to me, but it's a contribution claim.
It's a contribution claim by name. But at its root, it's a professional negligence claim. There's no privity here between the third-party defendant and the defendant in the case. The defendant is saying, you, third party who was never named in the lawsuit, you're responsible for the injury to the plaintiff.
But the plaintiff isn't saying that. Look, the plaintiff didn't have to tell you that he couldn't get an affidavit of merit. It seems to me that the beef of the third-party defendants is that they haven't gotten an affidavit of merit from the third-party plaintiff. If you got that, you'd be plenty happy. Am I right?
Probably not.
An affidavit of merit should be required.
Okay, so if it came from the third party, you wouldn't be arguing to us if it came from the plaintiff, the third-party plaintiff, correct?
Absolutely. If the third-party, if the defendant who's seeking to assert a claim for contribution, call it contribution, that is rooted in professional negligence, must comply because that party is a plaintiff.
So someone has to bring that issue to us.
Don't you think they knew that?
One day I think we'll have the case in front of us.
Counsel, I'm sorry, Chief. Go ahead.
No.
Don't you think they knew that? That's why they filed a motion to say that they weren't required to provide an affidavit of merit because they knew they needed one, they knew they couldn't get one, and somebody dropped the ball somewhere and didn't oppose the motion. They say, no, they had to file one. Isn't that, don't you think that they knew that they had to file an affidavit of merit? That's why they filed that motion. And beyond that, at trial, they're still going to have to prove that the doctor was negligent. It's not, contribution doesn't mean I get contribution. You have to show that the doctor deviated from the standard of care in such a fashion that they're entitled to contribution from that doctor. They'll need experts for that. So it's not the picture that you paint.
I'm going to try to answer two questions at once.
Good, because I can answer about six at a time.
But first, I believe that the question is before this court. Because in Burt, what the appellate division decided was that in a case where there is no affidavit of merit against what became a non-party physician, Burt explained how you balance all of those hardships. The plaintiff who did not was unable to satisfy the affidavit of merit requirement, gets what he or she bargained for. No direct recovery or indirect recovery against a party who was never named. The defendant gets what it's entitled to under the joint tortfeasor act, and under the Comparative Negligence Act. It gets to say, I shouldn't be, just like the Wildwood case, Jones, I can't be prejudiced as a defendant by what a plaintiff didn't do. I have the right to only pay my fair share. And Burt harmonized that.
Burt, you know, so Burt is a different case. Burt's not even before us, okay? So this court has yet to give its stamp of approval on Burt. But in Burt, the plaintiff brought in a defendant that got dismissed because of the lack of an affidavit of merit or an untimely affidavit of merit. And at least in that case, the defendant could claim, you know, I was wrongfully brought into this case, and I had to get a dismissal. And therefore, going forward, there shouldn't be any allocation against me because of the wrongfully bringing me into the suit. I mean, that would be an equitable argument. That's completely different from what we have here because the plaintiff hasn't done anything wrong. The plaintiff didn't bring Fernandez in wrongfully. The plaintiff didn't file a complaint against Fernandez.
The statutory requirements of the affidavit of merit under those circumstances, I do not shed light on equity. There's no difference between, from a legal perspective, a physician who was improperly sued with the absence of an affidavit of merit, and a physician who was never sued because a plaintiff could not obtain an affidavit of merit.
So we're going in circle back to what the Chief Justice has said. That the elephant in the room is the fact that the third-party plaintiff didn't file an affidavit of merit, and that issue is not before us.
And
if you argued and were successful that it should be filed, then you wouldn't be arguing before us.
And as representing an amicus in this case, the position of the amicus is that this case before your honors, which does touch upon Burt, and concerns the appellate division's departure from Burt, it puts that issue squarely before
how
the
can
court.
Can we? Do we have Quest before us?
They're not appearing because the decision of this court has no bearing upon that.
It would if we said that the affidavit of merit applied to them. They would be here, and they would be yelling at the top of their lungs.
It respectfully, they would not, because they would be treated as a Burt defendant. No matter what, that defendant is going to get the benefit of ultimately paying its fair share, whether under Burt, where there will be a reduction in the molding, or under the Mejia decision, where some third-party defendant is ultimately going to be on the hook to pay real dollars. The problem that my constituency has is that there is now, as a result of the Mejia appellate court's decision, a circumstance where physicians are on the hook for, and by the way, an environment that's becoming increasingly hostile, the delivery of quality health care, to having yet one more distraction where they're on the hook for potential damages, real dollars, the distraction of having to go through litigation for a long time.
Why don't you have a remedy here? And that is, let some discovery take place. And I understand discovery is expensive even from the beginning. But let some basic discovery take place that would allow the third-party defendant to at least articulate a claim or decide whether it has a claim. And then you go before your judge and you say, I think this claim is meritless. I'm asking for a quick, and it's done all the time, a quick expert deadline so they can state their theory of liability against us. We don't know what it is, right?
That solution, I think, not in any way intentionally, but I think it really doesn't put enough value on something that the Burt Court and the legislature recognized. It's easy for lawyers to say, we're just going to do this and that and we'll file motions. For a litigant, for a physician, it's extremely taxing. The job of being a doctor has become the job of being a biller, the job of being a witness, the job of being a defendant, and right now it's the job of defending a case where there's no claim of negligence.
But there's a claim of negligence.
Why don't they file a motion to dismiss or fail to provide an affidavit of merit? And that'll stop the further. When the third-party complaint comes in, how about a timely motion to dismiss or fail to provide an affidavit of merit? and then the case, if they can't provide, when the case is over. So all these concerns about the doctors worrying about billing and providing health care and the lawsuit and depositions would be gone if a motion had been filed. They're filed every day by direct defendants against plaintiffs. I'm sure they could sitting over there tell you how many of those they receive.
There's a I can't speak to the practice in the case below, but from my point of view, there's a policy issue. And the policy issues we have for our conferences, in any instance with respect to affidavits.
That would bring it to a head, would it not?
It's
early in the case.
Effectively, your question is assuming the very principle that my constituencies are urging upon the court, which is if there is going to be a claim for contribution rooted in professional negligence, there should be an affidavit of merit. As of right now, essentially the question is, if I take your Honor's question and the Chief's question, and the Chief's points would be, well, that issue isn't really before us, even though we're arguing about it, you know, most of the time today. You know, let that happen in some other case, and the issue will be before your Honors in 9 months or whenever it reaches its course.
We don't deal with issues generally that are not raised by the parties. You would agree with that?
I agree 100%.
And if that issue came up, the party affected here, who was Quest, and perhaps a new amici would be interested in getting into that issue.
Well, the party who's affected here, Quest is not affected from any practical perspective, because again, whether they're treated as a Burt defendant or as a party with the contribution claim, they're getting the same benefit.
You're assuming we're blessing Burt right now, okay? And that's not even necessarily before us. Look, the issue could have been presented to us. It hasn't been presented to us. The thing that is that we're now talking all about, and as my fellow justices has brought up, the party most concerned about this issue would be Quest, because Quest would be losing its third party defendant on an issue that hasn't even been raised to this court.
Very respectfully, Your Honor, that's not the case, because Quest isn't losing a third party defendant. What Quest isn't losing anything, which is why Quest isn't here. Quest ultimately, whether it was prior to this decision, the law of the land for the last 20 years since 2001 from the appellate division was Burt. And what Quest had was a benefit of a Burt defendant, meaning it has the right to have
Burt,
its ultimate liability.
I'm going to repeat myself. The last time I'm going to do it, so forgive me. In Burt, the plaintiff filed against the defendant without an affidavit of merit, and that defendant was dismissed. That didn't happen here. The plaintiff did nothing wrong, did not file a claim against Fernandez and have Fernandez dismissed. That distinguishes this case from Burt. Am I correct?
Factually, yes, but as a practical matter, the plaintiff in this case did the right thing by attempting to get an affidavit of merit. The plaintiff was unable to find an independent physician to sign his or her name to a statutorily required document that says this is meritorious. And therefore, rather than bring a sham lawsuit, rather than take any other type of action, that plaintiff did what it's supposed to do. Whether that makes this plaintiff better, different than any other plaintiffs, I can't say. But what I know is that I don't think that a plaintiff gets credit for not suing someone that it had no right to sue. And the failure to obtain an affidavit
merit
is equivalent to failing to state a claim.
If the verdict comes in under 60%, the plaintiff only collects his share from Quest, and that's it. If the verdict comes in over 60%, the plaintiff collects the entire amount from Quest. And Quest is losing, based on what you said, the opportunity to have contribution from the doctor. So they do lose something. They lose the opportunity to have them 100% reduced by the doctor's negligence. And they're not here to defend that.
And Your Honor's question...
No, it's not that it was a question, it was a statement.
Your Honor's statement is taken to heart, and it assumes the statement that this court does not approve of the reasoning in Burt. And with all due respect to my colleagues, you made the point.
The reasoning in Burt is all about what happened in Burt, which is the plaintiff sued a party and failed on a statutory requirement. That's what happened in Burt, right?
But what was before this court was now what? What was before the appellate division? Well,
yeah.
Now what do we do? How do
okay.
we harmonize
but
these
that's
statutes?
That was the setting of Burt. This is a situation where the plaintiff has done what I think the legislature was hoping the plaintiff would do, which is not file a complaint without an expert having at least preliminarily opined that there was professional negligence. That's what the legislature was aiming for.
And it's the legislature was aiming to protect, in the affidavit of merit statute, physicians from being brought into lawsuits without having that benefit. And yet, in this case, now doctors in New Jersey are facing exactly that.
I think we have your argument.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Mr. Mahoney.
May it please the court, Brian Mahoney from Bloomfort for the plaintiff's respondents. In the Burt case, the appellate division was constrained to take action because the mischief of the plaintiff had resulted in the extinction of all the defendants' contribution cross claims. That's what happened in Burt. And so the appellate division had to intervene and set out an equitable way to level the playing field. The only similarity between this case and Burt is that these are both medical malpractice cases. That's where any similarity ends. In this case, plaintiffs did nothing wrong. There is no unjust procedural development that has disadvantaged anybody in this case. And I should introduce this court to Mr. Hensley from Quest. They're very interested in this. We didn't argue about the affidavit of merit in the appellate division, and we didn't argue about it in the law division. Third-party defendant's interest in the affidavit of merit statute comes a little too late. And as the court has pointed out more than once, there was an opportunity to speak in the court below, and third-party defendant Fernandez said nothing. We have done nothing wrong. As Justice Patterson pointed out, it might be said that we were aware of the statutory framework. We were aware of the incentives and disincentives that face plaintiffs bringing these cases, and we acted appropriately. We refrained from suing Dr. Fernandez. And counsel for the amicus makes the argument that it's a hostile world out there. It takes 5 years for a doctor to clear his name. Well, the system's working great because plaintiffs didn't file an unjust suit against Dr. Fernandez. So there's no reason to grant the relief that third-party defendant seeks today. Every single direct defendant in this case has an intact contribution claim. We have not extinguished anybody's contribution claims. What third-party defendant Fernandez's counsel wants is to be excused from having to show up at trial. He would like us to prejudge the facts and give Dr. Fernandez a free pass, and then he'll be scandalized in the law division trial as an empty chair, a defenseless empty chair. And maybe the jury will assign a great percentage to him in the trial court, but he'll never have to pay a dollar. Now, is that helping Dr. Fernandez? Dr. Fernandez needs more due process, not less. He paid insurance premiums to get coverage from NJ Cure, who assigned a counsel and has been working hard on the case for 5 years and now would like to just not show up at time of trial. That would have an avulsive impact on the adversary system. We don't want to have empty chairs created by artificial advantages sought at the 11th hour by counsel such as counsel for third-party defendant Fernandez.
Representing plaintiff, what would be your position if, in a case like this, third-party defendant came forward and said, I want an adjudication early on the merits of this claim? In other words, court require the third-party defendant to provide an expert's report early, and I want to test it because, as the plaintiff's action in not suing me reflects, I wasn't the party responsible here. Would you oppose that kind of quick resolution of the third-party complaint? I know that's a what if, but just in terms of how case management?
Well, equality is equity. So I favor a symmetry of burdens for those who, as defendants, are asserting a claim against a third-party defendant doctor. And maybe in the law division's discretion managing discovery, it
but you see the difference. The difference between you and presumably, and obviously a very well-experienced counsel, you've been working with your client, working with your experts. You don't have to answer this, you know, tell us what you've been doing, but you've had a while to prepare your case before the complaint is filed, and then you have more knowledge of it until discovery somewhat evens the playing field in terms of knowledge. You would agree with that?
Yes.
So the defendant who is sued in these circumstances, a third-party defendant, comes in and doesn't have that information. Maybe can look at the medical records or part of the medical records, but not a whole lot of information of the nature of the claim. Wouldn't it be equitable for a court to, you know, assuming all the other things are equal, allow for a quick disposition of a claim right up front, as soon as there's enough information and discovery?
Well, of course, we don't have law division judges scrutinizing plaintiffs' affidavits of merit. All the plaintiff's expert has to say in that affidavit is there's a basis to find a deviation from accepted standards of care. It might be nice if third-party defendant Fernandez could have received that assurance in some form, but to have the whole case laid out in detailed early discovery, I don't know about that.
Have you ever had any case where a judge has required a third-party plaintiff to file an affidavit of merit?
I haven't seen it. I have not seen it. So I guess I can't help Your Honor in that respect. Well, what they wish to do in order to get the relief they seek, that is, have Dr. Fernandez be absent at time of trial. In order for that to work without prejudicing others, they want this court to strip my plaintiff of the right to pursue 100% recovery against a 60% or more at fault defendant. And there's nothing exotic about this 60% or more at fault defendant. Out-of-town amicus might find it strange that New Jersey settled on the 60% floor when it comes to joint and several liability, but it's been a feature of New Jersey jurisprudence going back to 1874 in one form or the other. In fact, during the first 13 years of the Comparative Negligence Act, a 2% at fault defendant could be held responsible for the 100% if it were convenient for a plaintiff to get the recovery from that 2% at fault individual.
So historically, it was pro rata, right? So it was totally bad luck or good luck, depending on as to how many defendants were in.
Well, the way it worked, yes. Before 1952, there were no contribution claims. But if plaintiff proved that a defendant was a culpable tortfeasor, yes or no, 100% responsible, even if there's four defendants in the case. They're all 100% responsible. Mm-hmm. Plaintiff's not allowed to get a 400% recovery. There can't be any double payments there. And then in 1952, we had the joint tortfeasors contribution law come into place so that there could be a sharing in terms of pro rata shares. It would be assumed that four culpable defendants were 25% each responsible and would thereby reimburse each other any overpayments made as a consequence of plaintiff's collection efforts. There's no irreparable harm here based on the awkward situation where Dr. Fernandez is being sued on a third-party complaint. The third-party practice has been a part of the New Jersey court rules since forever, at least as long in my experience. The entire appellate division argument by the third-party defendant requires this court to prejudge facts. Isn't Mr. Brennan really saying, let's say plaintiff made a mistake? He keeps saying plaintiff didn't perfect a claim against Dr. Fernandez. Well, wouldn't it be more accurate to say we never brought a claim against Dr. Fernandez? But in essence, what he's saying is plaintiff made a mistake. He did not sue my doctor. My doctor was at fault, and now my doctor's being inconvenienced, and my insurance company has to pay for me to go try the case.
Well, I didn't hear him say his doctor was at fault.
Well, I've heard counsel say that maybe plaintiffs dropped the ball here. We didn't perfect our claim. We never presented a claim. The system is working properly. And Amica stands up and says this case will have a broad impact on the medical profession because the atmosphere out there is hostile. And I think it's counterintuitive for the insurance company to be taking the position it is today. They want to abandon their defense of Dr. Fernandez and have an empty chair at time of trial. That is not a just solution to their concerns. As I say, Dr. Fernandez needs more due process, not less. Also, Young versus Lotta stands for the proposition that if a attorney is going to adopt a momentous, exotic, comparative fault argument, the outlines of this must be disclosed as early as possible in discovery, because we don't want to ambush anybody. Now, defense counsel for third-party defendant Fernandez came up with these ideas about somehow getting Dr. Fernandez out of the trial just as we were wrapping up expert discovery. My office does not have an expert to defend Dr. Fernandez. Yes, we have a report in our file from the pre-suit period where a doctor said there's no basis to sue Dr. Fernandez.
Why did you disclose that? Were you obliged to disclose that? Because now it's being used against you.
I don't believe I was obliged to turn it over. It was an internal work product.
Right, so you did
but
it.
Maybe it would have been smart.
Yeah,
you
because your adversaries are now using that against you because you disclosed it to them. They're saying you had no suit against him. Now he should be out of the case.
I had a pre-suit expert say there is no case against Dr. Fernandez.
No, I understand
Fernandez.
That.
Do not sue Dr. Fernandez. Okay,
but
we won't.
But you had no obligation to disclose that to anyone.
No, I did not. Although, in hindsight, if I had been told when this was a young case that Dr. Fernandez had some exotic ideas, I would have brought out that expert and said, well, we're going to use this expert to defend Dr. Fernandez. As it stands now, I don't have an expert to defend Dr. Fernandez. Third-party defendant's counsel has a Dr. Ainsley. Dr. Ainsley, he's not our first choice. We should have known about this.
Third-party defendant's counsel or third-party plaintiff's counsel?
Third-party defendant, Dr. Fernandez.
Oh, he has an
counsel,
expert.
Mr. Brennan,
okay,
has an expert ready to go.
So
the expert's name is Ainsley.
So if we would actually rule the way the defendants want us to rule, then you would have to defend. You would be forced to actually to defend Fernandez.
Of course.
You'd have to put your expert to show he wasn't liable so that you could point the full blame at Quest.
That's
what
the
system
expects of me.
You're going to do that anyway because Quest defenses, it's the doctor, and you wouldn't rather go just against Quest. That's who you sued. So you're going to do that direct or indirectly during
the
trial.
Those are the cards on the table. And I wish I had known about this when we had more than about a month to go in discovery. I could have gotten our expert out of the closet to defend Fernandez. I could have gone out and picked someone We don't even know if Ainslie would cooperate with us because his deposition's been taken. Would you ever come to court and testify for Bloomfort? Well, gee, I don't know. He was equivocal. So we're in a strange situation. Our incentive is to see Dr. Fernandez freed of liability of any sort.
But you're always in that situation, not always, but you're frequently in that situation because of the allocation, right? If you've settled with somebody, if they're dismissed for another reason, if it's appropriate reason.
Yeah,
so that's not that uncommon to see for a plaintiff to be in that situation.
Yeah, the strategies of the different parties to the case on things like settlement, they can be good strategies or bad. The system will penalize us depending on whose ox gets gored, so we have to choose wisely. But this thing with Dr. Fernandez being an empty chair at time of trial, that was sprung on us with about a month left in discovery. And so that's not fair. Shouldn't be allowed. It's kind of like arguing the affidavit of merit in front of the Supreme Court where it hasn't been mentioned for the past 10 months. Unless there's further questions, that's my presentation.
Any questions? Thank you. Mr. Butcher?
May it please the court. I am mindful that Your Honor has made the point that you are not here to answer the question that I placed in my brief suggesting this court should accept sua sponte. I had hoped that as an amicus counsel presenting that, someone in this matter who has significant interest in this would in fact step in and do so. Unfortunately, that hasn't happened. So I have to simply say that since that is obviously, as I think someone's already said, the pink elephant in the room, I will move on.
I think you just gave it the pink color. It was an elephant in the room before.
It was an elephant until
but now is an even more impressive elephant.
Even more impressive, this one? Okay. And so as a result, I have to move to the discussion of what really is before the court, which is the question of, let's look at, number one, what should happen whatever the determination is. Let's assume that ultimately someday this court does get a case, the court concludes an affidavit of merit is not required in a contribution third party claim, or decides it is. If they say not, we still have to address what happens in a trial scenario like this. If the court says it does, well, let's assume then one does get served and there is in fact an individual with a claim. What has to happen is that there needs to be a participation by that third party defendant because the allocation process requires that there be a full-throated defense of that individual. Mr. Brennan says, who is here to watch out for Dr. Fernandez? Well, the answer is clear. That's Mr. Brennan. Having had him as an adversary, he is a skillful adversary, and he will do everything he can, hopefully, to defend Dr. Fernandez and see to it that the outcome of a trial is ultimately that the Quest defendants are 100% responsible, and Dr. Fernandez, if that is true, will walk away without having to contribute anything back to Quest. But the plaintiff in this scenario, so long as Quest is found 60% or greater, should suffer no loss where plaintiff has done what the system has asked them to do. The affidavit of merit asks them not to bring a claim where they cannot establish that there is merit. The plaintiff did that. The system essentially says that to the extent that there is comparative fault, that a court will make that determination. They're there to present that.
Mr. Butcher, how is the plaintiff hurt? What am I missing here?
I'm saying the plaintiff shouldn't be, Your Honor.
Right, but how is the plaintiff hurt? $100,000 verdict, just for a round number, 70% liability. They go after the third party defendant for contribution. You get your hundred, or not you, but a plaintiff, member of your organization, gets the $100,000. Why? What's the prejudice to the plaintiff there?
So long as the court continues in the manner that you've described, there is no prejudice to the plaintiff. I perceive the defendant's argument here to be asking the court to invoke a prejudice to the plaintiff. What they're essentially saying is, if you, the plaintiff, despite having in good faith sought an affidavit of merit and having gotten one, don't sue our individual directly. You can't collect from them. That's wrong. That is not at all what is the intent of the affidavit of merit. It's not what's the intent of the comparative fault law. It's not what's the intent of the contribution law. Your Honor said at the beginning.
A plaintiff isn't collecting from them. If they don't sue them, they're collecting from the defendant against whom they sued.
Correct.
So, that's the beginning and the end of that.
I agree. The defendant in this instance, the third-party defendant in this instance, seems to be presenting to the court an argument that they believe that because the plaintiff had no affidavit of merit, the plaintiff should suffer a consequence by not collecting that portion, effectively arguing that this is Burt, that this court should approve of Burt, and that there isn't a distinction. Justice Patterson made a very clear distinction that in Burt there was an inaction on the plaintiff's counsel's instance that prejudiced the third-party plaintiff, and therefore that was the reason for why Burt suggested that there would be a consequence. We don't have that here. And I would like to suggest one thing. Justice Patterson, you raised the question about what about an accelerated process in these instances. Couple things that just since I'm here as an amicus counsel suggesting if the court is going to address something in that regard. Number one, Justice Fernandez-Vina, you said, what about a Ferrara conference? In this setting, we'd have to effectively establish the necessity for a second Ferrara conference because the one that had taken place initially would not have included this participant. So we would need to make it clear that we need, in these cases, to have a second Ferrara conference. But I do think, Your Honor, there is a mechanism by which the defense could get to the same, you know, place, even with or without an affidavit of merit, and that is that while they do get a somewhat undefined complaint by it being contribution, serve your interrogatories with your answer. 60 days later, either you have them or you don't. That's the same 60 days that you'd have if there was an affidavit of merit required. You now know that they're making an allegation premised upon you having some basis for this being, you know, in the form of a malpractice claim, and have the court then say, fine, in the next 60 days, defendant, a third-party plaintiff, you're going to have to provide an expert report.
There has to be consideration of the inequity at that point in terms of knowledge between the plaintiff, who knows his or her case very well, has access to all the facts, presumably.
In defense of my colleague, I need to point out to the court that while there's a 2-year period of a statute of limitations, not all of our clients walk in the door. In fact, none of our clients
on
walk
day
in
three?
The door on day three. It's much more common they walk in somewhere in about 18 months because, unfortunately, a common occurrence is they may suffer an injury that somebody tells them is going to get better over time.
But the fact is you have time.
We have time.
To develop the case, to study the medical records, to talk to experts. Somebody gets sued, has a short time period to answer,
sure.
File a third-party complaint. They don't have a lot of information.
No, but the third-party plaintiff has from us as a defendant already the medical records of the individual and certainly can be, if you're going to, again, look at an early resolution, compelled to produce those to the third-party defendant in a short period so the third-party defendant can develop an understanding of what the case is or isn't. What we shouldn't allow is the potentiality that this works to a detriment, other than the potential detriment the plaintiff made a improper decision not to sue Dr. Fernandez in a situation where Quest is found to be less than 60% responsible. Plaintiff should be able to make their full recovery, and it is entirely an instance where Quest then gets to collect its contribution from the defendant. I have nothing further unless the court has questions for me.
One follow-up, Chief, if I may. Have you ever heard of a judge taking the position that a third-party plaintiff has to file an affidavit of merit?
That they have to? No. That they don't have to? Yes. And it is problematic in the sense of society.
I'm sorry.
It is problematic in this instance. I will tell the court that I am handling a somewhat similar matter where Quest is the direct defendant and where Quest has third-partied the obstetrician who was found by my reviewer pre-suit not to have been in any way at fault. So I can tell you that I'm here in part recognizing full well exactly what is the scenario that occurs in this instance.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your
Honor. Mr. Brennan.
Thank you. So this is the first time that I've had the proud pleasure of appearing before this esteemed body.
Come back again.
Yes. And I'm a trial attorney. I'm not an appellate guy. But as a trial attorney, I know how to read the room. So I'm not going to repeat the arguments that I made, but I do want to mention something that's extremely important to me. Whether the elephant is pink or not, at this point, the elephant's sitting on my chest. And the reason that it's sitting on my chest is that it's been suggested somehow that there wouldn't have been a problem if we only moved to dismiss the third-party claim by saying they needed an affidavit of merit. And I don't think that that respectfully is necessarily true. And there
we're hearing from other counsel. They never heard of any judge ruling that way.
Well, but there's no case law on this. I shouldn't say there's no case law on this issue. There's a law division case by Judge Massano out of Hudson County, which is the Nagim case, N-A-G-I-M. And there's an appellate division case, Manganaro, which also discusses the issue. But in both those cases, and you're going to forget about me when I leave this courtroom, but if this issue ever comes up before Your Honor, and Your Honors, and I think it will, as to whether a third-party plaintiff has to file an affidavit of merit, both those cases, the only cases on this issue throughout the state, dealt with the situation where there was a contractual relationship between the third-party plaintiff and the third-party defendant. So when we were faced with a situation as to whether we were going to oppose that motion, and I know I sound defensive, but with good reason, the way I viewed the world at that point, there's no third-party plaintiff that's going to have problems getting an affidavit of merit. There's no third-party plaintiff who's going to have a problem, Your Honor, even if I put to their feet to the fire early to get an expert report, they're going to get that expert report. It's a wasted motion. And I don't think any of Your Honors would be shocked, especially Your Honors who were trial attorneys. If you can't get an affidavit of merit from one doctor, you go to another doctor. If you can't get it from that doctor, you go to a third doctor. I don't think there's, and maybe call me cynical, but you're eventually going to find somebody in California or North Dakota. You'll go wherever you have to go to get the affidavit of merit. We see this all the time. So, and again, the legislature said plaintiffs have to get an affidavit of merit. I don't really think personally that it does anything to stop litigation against doctors, because they're always going to be able to find a doctor who's going to file an affidavit of merit. I mean, let's kind of really talk about the real situation that's going on with medical malpractice litigation. So we make these attorneys jump through the hoops, and we're going to Ferreira conferences and all these things. That's only where a plaintiff's attorney basically doesn't do his or her job and doesn't file it in the right time. But attorneys like Mr. Britcher, attorneys like Mr. Mahoney, they'll get their affidavits of merit. They're not just going to not pursue a case because they can't get an affidavit of merit. Sometimes I had to go to five doctors, Your Honor, in order to get an expert report in the case. But that's what you do. So why didn't we file a motion putting the third-party plaintiff's feet to the fire? Because the law office is the law office of William Brennan. And I take responsibility for not filing that motion. It wouldn't have done any good. They would have gotten an expert report. They would have went out and got an affidavit of merit. I'm just wasting trees at that point filing that motion. Now, maybe I'm cutting my own throat. And again, you'll probably forget this argument once it's ever raised, but it really is not going to protect my client, because eventually I'm going to be sued in the case anyway.
Well, what's so interesting, you're obviously telling us that this law is like a big waste of time. I hear you. But on the other hand, you're willing to use it today against the plaintiff for not having filed a direct affidavit of merit against you.
That's exactly what I'm doing, 100%. Because what William Brennan
that's
is doing
advocacy. That's called advocacy.
And I'm being honest. I mean, you play with the rules you dealt with, yes? So I'm not going to look behind the legislature's wisdom in doing the affidavit of merit, right? But I'm just trying to speak to you as to the realities of the situation. So those are the two things that I really wanted to point out rather than re-argue anything that I've already said. Thanks again for your time and attention.
Thank you. Mr. Brennan, I meant it. We like good lawyers here. Trial court lawyers, appellate lawyers, you can come back today. Feel free to sit. Today we had fine, very fine presentations.
Thank you, Honor.
And I want to say to the amicus in particular, you heard questions from a number of us about the scope of the issues that the court will hear in this case. If we don't reach the issue, we'll welcome you back as amici in the next case. Thank you. We're going to have the discipline.